Hey, how you doing? I'm Steve Thurland. Welcome to another one. This episode of Being Freelance is supported by Riverside. High quality audio and video remotely. Perfect, obviously, for podcasters, streamers, or for that matter, if you're recording video testimonials of your freelance clients. But what I love about Riverside isn't just the recording, it's what happens after. So once I've hit stop, it picks out highlight video clips for me to use on social media. I can tweak them to suit my brand, automatically change the format to suit the social platform I'm putting them out on, like vertical or anyway. That's all within Riverside itself. And believe me, I have used a lot of these tools. I've tried it a lot, both with Being Freelance stuff and my clients. It is such a time saver. Plus, you can even edit by deleting bits of the transcripts, use AI to tidy up the edit, create show notes. Seriously, take a look at Riverside. See how it can fit in with what you're doing. If you're live streaming to LinkedIn, think about the way you could also record that in quality and then create these clips really quickly. It's a repurposing dream. Go to beingfreelance.com/riverside to find out more. You can get started for free, but if you do end up getting a paid plan, make sure you use the code Being Freelance, all one word, Being Freelance, because it will save you 15%. Use the code Being Freelance. This episode was recorded using Riverside, but who's it with? Well, this time we're finding out what it's like being freelance for logo designer James Barnard.
Instagram is by far the biggest lead generator for me. It was kind of a huge mind-blowing moment, like, why have I not been doing this sooner? I'm better on camera. Now I'm better at articulating with clients. It makes me a better salesperson. I'm totally getting practice by making this content that I'm actually able to talk to clients with more conviction and more gusto, and it has so many benefits. It's ridiculous. I'm very lucky. I do have two young children. The freelance lifestyle means that I'm home for every dinner. I get to put them down every night for bed and spend as much time with them as I possibly can. I don't want to have it any other way now. I don't think I could ever go back to a full-time role. I'm too far gone now. I'm a freelancer for life.
Yeah, so there is James, his story coming up in a moment. By the way, there is a video version of this episode as well on YouTube. I don't do it for all the episodes, but there is one for this. Hope you're good. Hope you're well. It's pretty busy in the Being Freelance community at the moment. Remember, you're not alone being freelance. Do you know that feeling? Like, it's great. I love being a freelancer, but it is isolating, particularly if you work from home. So to have people to cheer you on, to bounce ideas around with, it's such a good feeling. Potentially could find you work as well as you get referred or collaborate. We also have lots of events going on, stuff like socials, both in person, online. We've got one in Manchester, Newcastle, London very soon as well. In fact, a couple in London. We're going to Adobe Max. Also got a social one on a roof terrace once the summer kicks in. So yeah, lots going on. All you need to do is go to beingfreelance.com and click on community, and I'll say hi to you in there. So if you enjoyed the podcast, please do come and find us. Beingfreelance.com, click on community. Right now, though, we're off to Australia to find out what it's like being freelance for logo designer James Barnard. Hey, James.
How's it going? How's the weather back in the UK?
As you can tell, James isn't from Australia, but we'll find out how he ended up there, perhaps as part of this story. As ever, how about we get started hearing how you got started being freelance?
Sure. I am a logo designer, but previously my first job in graphic design was just a generic all-rounder digital designer. My first job in design was for a publishing company. I worked for Natmags, which then turned into Hearst Rodale. So I worked for Runner's World magazine and Men's Health magazine on their sort of advertising and editorial teams, just doing things like email newsletters, flash adverts, that kind of stuff. And then I sort of bounced my way around a few different publishing houses. I went to Bauer Media and then eventually the Daily Telegraph, which is like kind of like my last full-time role. It actually wasn't my last full-time role, because the one I went into after that, which was like head of digital for the Times and the Sun, I absolutely hated. And it's the reason I went freelance. It pushed me into that freelance career, which is my final full-time role was doing so little of the actual graphic design work and more of the kind of managerial side of things that I just was not enjoying it anymore. There's too much admin, too much putting out fires, dealing with little, you know, managerial issues and HR things that weren't to do with the actual grunt work of design. And I just missed it. I missed it so much. I think I lasted 6 weeks in that role. I quit the job with no other job to go into and went freelance, inverted commas, to try and pay the bills while I found something new. And really quickly, after maybe a few weeks of the new freelance life, I realized this is all right. I can take naps in the middle of the day. I can just run an errand whenever I want and not have to be under anybody's thumb. And I never went back. And that was something like 8 or 9 years ago.
Nice.
But I started out as like a gun for hire. I went to all the agencies in London, tried to find just work, just to pay the bills while I had absolutely no work coming in. So I was like a freelancer on a day rate. I would go into the office, do what they told me. And then after a little while, COVID sort of happened and my first child was born. And I was then working from home a lot more. So I was trying to find my own clients. And yeah, things kind of sort of snowballed from there.
When you were going into the agencies, what do you feel worked for you there? Like, did you struggle to find the work?
No, honestly, I didn't. I found it quite easy, if I'm honest, because I had that background of working in the publishing industry, and especially somewhere like the Daily Telegraph, where the deadlines were so intense. It was a daily national newspaper. We worked really quickly there. So that was like a real baptism of fire. Like I was, absolutely flying when I worked in Daily Telegraph. And also it got me loads of experience in print and digital. So I was kind of like a really good all-rounder, known for being kind of quick in the software. So when I went into agencies, sat down at a desk, I was absolutely flying. They were giving me work and I was turning it over so quickly, they were struggling to find work for me. Which was kind of good and bad because, obviously you want to do a good job for them and work quickly. But a lot of the time, I won't lie, I was sat there twiddling my thumbs waiting for work to come in.
And you'd obviously been an experienced and, high, big companies. Like, had you built up a network, was that any use to you? Or was it almost like starting from scratch going in, albeit, here's my experience to show you?
Yeah, I had a portfolio. So there were some odd clients trickling in. And I also was burning the candle at both ends while I had my full-time role. I was pulling freelance jobs for my own clients evenings and weekends while I was working alongside a full-time role. Also, when I was in the publishing industry, they have, let's say an industry like Bauer Media, they have something like 20 magazines, more than that. I'm sure they do. It's absolutely huge library of magazines that they have. And each one of those departments always needs extra design resource filling. So what would happen was I would end up doing little odd jobs for those magazines for different departments and earning kind of bonus money on top of my salary each month, which was actually paid through my normal salary, but it was like my own little sort of half freelance gig at the time. So when I eventually went freelance and pulled the plug on that last full-time role, I had some contacts already from the industry that I could kind of lean on. But it was kind of, it wasn't great fun work. It was a lot of, digital display advertising, a lot of JPEG outputs, that kind of stuff. So it wasn't very much fun. Paid the bills, but it wasn't very rewarding. So I kind of dropped that as soon as I kind of could and took on a couple of retainer clients just through contacts that I'd made in the industry and a little bit of SEO help as well. So this is way before I was doing the logo design thing. I hadn't sort of niched down into logo design until something like 5 years ago. So I was doing everything, absolutely everything, being the sort of generic, saturated market of generic graphic design, print advertising, flyers, email newsletters, you name it, I could do it. It wasn't until I decided to sort of niche down into logos that finding the clients actually became easier. Setting yourself as an expert in one thing allows you to attract more clients, as backwards as that sounds. Being targeted in one area totally allowed me to sort of target more logo design clients and therefore actually get more from that by being the kind of expert in that niche.
Yeah. Did you know what you were doing business-wise when you stepped out?
Nope, not at all. I had it's one of the horrible things about our industry is that there's very little education around like the actual business of design, what to do in terms of like how to price your work, how to deal with clients, how to run retainers or timesheets and all that stuff. I learned a lot about sort of timesheeting and billing from my time in agencies, but it wasn't until I started watching all of Chris Doe's content from the future when I started learning about the business of design, like how to value what I do, how to put a price on it, how to package it up so it's easier to sell it. And I basically took my website and sort of rewrote everything on the site to target better SEO terms so I could be more discoverable, And to put my logo design packages on there sort of as a tiered structure, you know, good, better, best. And that meant for a lot more leads. But my SEO was really, really good. It was something like, if you Googled freelance logo designer London, I came up as number one. All because I tweaked a few things on my website. I changed the copy and the content just to kind of, once I decided to niche into that area, really sort of specialize on it, removed all the portfolio work off my portfolio that wasn't to do with logo design. So it was absolutely specialized. And that just started bringing the clients in. It wasn't like crazy amounts of leads, but it was decent and it was enough to live on.
Yeah. It's interesting you say about timesheets and, you know, your first experience in an agency was of a day rate. And yet, because you'd worked in this intense atmosphere in the press, you were quick. So did you feel like you were being penalized by charging for your time?
Totally. And it took me so long to realize that. You think like by working faster, people will hire you because you're more efficient. But you're right. You get penalized because you work quickly, especially if you're charging hourly. So yeah, it was a huge kind of like bombshell moment when I realized like, this is insane. Why am I billing hourly on little projects like that? I guess at the time it was because I was working on lots of small little projects and it was easier to do that rather than sort of bundling things up as like a package of, say, like digital display design work and giving them a certain number of deliverables rather than a certain number of hours. That would have been made much more sense. And I could have just bust those out really quickly, do them in half an hour and charge four times what I would have been paid hourly. But yeah, it did take me a while to kind of realize that. But as soon as I kind of figured it out, it meant that, you know, I had a kind of floor price for everything. And it meant that it was easier to bill clients. They knew upfront what the whole project was going to cost. And it just made for a much more sort of better customer experience. It was just finding that sweet spot with pricing that is still today, you know, one of the hardest parts about what I do, actually. It's so fluid. I made a massive mistake a few years back of putting my prices on my website. Like that, I was getting kind of annoyed with people asking me to do logos for 50 quid. And, you know, it's kind of insulting when someone of my experience is asked, you know, to either do something for free or to do something on the cheap. And so what I did was I put my floor price on my website and I got no leads in 2 months. So it was just a case of, you know, actually getting people to inquire and then eking out a price from them and working with them to find their budget and guiding them through that process a little bit more was the way to do it, rather than going, this is my floor price, it's set in stone, it's my way or the highway, which just didn't work. And I almost went under, I'm not going to lie. Like the 2 months with absolutely no leads coming through dried my cash flow up completely until I tried everything to kind of like stop it from going under. I threw money at like Facebook advertising and Google advertising to try and get people to my website. That was a total disaster. I halved the price of the floor price to see if that would bring in leads. That didn't work. It was just the case of that price being on the website was so, it was so easy for someone to go somewhere else and just bounce to a competitor that until I removed it and then started those conversations back up from the ground up, you know, it was just a total disaster. It just did not work.
Man, that is so interesting because I mean, obviously, it's a very nuanced discussion, the whole prices on the website thing. But that experience is so clear cut. Even then, though, how do you... So you take away the price, you're getting lots of leads. How do you then not spend all your time dealing with people who are still trying to get you for 50 quid, for example? Like, what's that process like of filtration?
Yeah, because I went through that experience of nearly losing my business because of this pricing problem, I then suddenly started looking at that in lead gen in a totally new light and was like, okay, I don't mind dealing with those kinds of queries anymore. Just give me leads. And if there's money to sort of massage out of a client, I can. It's interesting, while that those prices were on my website, the work that I did get was through somewhere completely different. It was like a Reddit post someone found me through. They hadn't seen my prices, came through. It was a logo design job or a t-shirt design job for a motorcycle club based in Texas. Like the coolest project you can imagine. I would have done it for free probably because it was just such a great project to work on. I think I got something like 500 quid for it. At the time, I was like, cha-ching, yes, thank you very much. But I would not have got that job had they gone through my website and seen the prices. They just would have gone somewhere else. So that was quite an interesting experiment that I probably missed out on a lot of opportunities where I might have taken the job on for cheap because the job was cool or the timeline extended or other deliverables could have been cut from the project. And that's what this project kind of made me realize is that you need to have a discussion. You need to talk to that client before you go back to them really with a budget, or at least find out a bit more about them so that you can kind of figure out where they are on the grand scheme of things, and then sort of start massaging that budget out of them and working with them to kind of show the value of what you're bringing rather than, you know, here's my hourly rate. This is how much it's going to cost. It's more about the return on their investment rather than, you know, that upfront cost. And then from there, like, because it's logo design, I can kind of upsell services. So start with a logo, use the logo as the starting point of the sale, and then add things like websites and marketing material and business cards and all that jazz.
You say massage, though. What's the Barnard massage like?
This needs to be branded, doesn't it? Needs to be something on my website. The Barnard massage. Welcome.
It's just like, because obviously you could have a conversation. You could get in fact, I've done this. You know, you get really excited. Oh, I could be editing this person's podcast. These guys seem like really great people. I really like this. And sure, on some instances, I might then tell them the price and then they might say, nah, we really can't. And I'm like, oh, but I love your project so much. And we negotiate. But on somebody else, I might just have to say goodbye and think, did I waste? Is that time wasted? Or is that somebody who might come back further down the line? If I'd only have bought up budget sooner, would they have stayed?
Here's how I handle this at the moment. Okay, so when you want to get in contact with me via my website, you go through a funnel. So there's like a short questionnaire. It's only like 4 questions. The very first question is, what is your budget range? And that ranges from something like 0 to 1,000, 1,000 to 5,000, 5,000 to 10, and 10,000 plus. Whatever box they tick immediately tells me they value this project. And most of them, you know, as you'd expect, would tick the lower end box. Those guys get an email that I don't spend as much time trying as hard with those guys. I'll send them an email saying, you're not quite there on the sort of level that we're playing at here. Would you be open to spending a little bit more to discuss this? And that's just off an email straight off the bat. So immediately I've crossed that bridge. I've dealt with the budget issue immediately and told them, you know, we're not quite on the same page. Would you be willing to increase to sort of, you know, bridge that gap? The ones that have ticked over, they get a dedicated, detailed response from me based on some of the questions that they've answered. And then usually I get on the call with them as soon as I possibly can. So schedule a call here, that kind of thing. And that allows me to kind of have that conversation and find out a little bit more about the project, find out more about their timelines. So if it's a longer lead, if it can be done in like 3 months or so, maybe we can bring the price down this first time. And on the proviso that if we work together in the future, I'd have to charge where I normally charge, that kind of wording. So it's all about having that first conversation. But yeah, I totally deal with the budget straight away. It's the first thing you see on my form on my website. And that kind of just sets the tone right off the bat.
Okay. What about retainers, though? You've mentioned them. Are you still... once you've decided to niche... Oh, okay, go on. what was your experience of retainers like? Maybe it just doesn't suit... Maybe it just doesn't suit logos in the same way.
If there's a bit of an offboarding process, let's say I upscale and I, you know, provide something like a website, or maybe they have things like a pitch deck that they aren't willing to do themselves in something like PowerPoint, and they need a bit of design expertise going forward. I have one or two clients where I do work on retainer with them. I don't like it though, if I'm honest, because with retainers, it's like hourly. And you have to kind of timesheet it, and there's no real way around it in my experience. So I do that kind of few and far between. Logo design is like more of a project. I can put a price on that project based on a certain number of deliverables, and then they pay a half upfront deposit, and then the final deposit is paid once the logo files have been delivered. So it's really set in stone. It's contracted. You kind of can't move away from that. If they move outside of things like revisions or, you know, like numbers of amends on a project, or they don't get back to me within a certain period, there are clauses in my terms of service that allow me to either to stop that job or to switch to an extortionate hourly rate to take on, you know, revisions and amends. So, yeah, I like to deal with pricing on a kind of project basis. It just makes more sense for me.
Yeah. How do most of your clients find you today? Is it still via SEO?
It was until my social media exploded. It's something like 85% of my clients now come through Instagram, TikTok, or a little bit on YouTube. Instagram is by far the biggest lead generator for me. It's huge. It's absolutely massive. And that's all become from like the first time I kind of went viral on TikTok. I posted basically something of me showing off. I got a couple of my logos, got into a book called The Logo Lounge, and that video did 3 million views. And overnight, I got 70 leads for logo design, which is more I'd got in like, I don't know, months prior to that. And then I was booked out for 3 months solid. So, and I have been booked out like that ever since. So social media is just, it was kind of a huge mind-blowing moment. Like, why have I not been doing this sooner? And started putting way more effort into making good social media content that gives back to clients and designers. And that's kind of been the story from here on in. It's just, it's, you know, it's where the love is. All that little, I'm going to put more attention to that as a lead generator.
Totally. When did you start, well, putting out more concerted stuff on social media?
So I was always on like Instagram doing things like time-lapse videos of me working in Adobe Illustrator, showing off my work. So if I ever got a new logo design project, I'd do a carousel post and show off the work that I'd just done. But no one really seemed to care about the portfolio side of things. You know, no one really gives a toss when you launch a new logo project. It's cool for you and it's awesome to share, but no one really cares, do they? The things they do care about is when they get value out of your content. So as soon as you start teaching people or explaining difficult concepts in things like graphic design or logo design specifically for me, or showing your work, but in a way that kind of shows the process. So I do a lot of case studies on my account in a video process and talk about how we got to that final design with rounds of amends, the routes that we took, the sketches I did, dealing with the client and their feedback, and then showing the final product. And that kills. That's really great for both designers and clients, because designers are learning about the process and how that it might work for them, or how they should deal with clients themselves. And then any clients watching this, or people who want logos and seeing, you know, this is what it might be like to work with me in the future. How do I get in touch with this guy? So it kind of is so self-serving. It's fantastic. It's like I'm helping out one side of the audience and getting leads from the other. It's brilliant.
How much time does dealing with social media, and actually there's probably two sides to that. There's probably content creation and just being social on social media. Maybe.
Yeah, it's huge. It is a huge chunk of my time now. But I talk about this guy all the time, Jamie Brindle. He's like this freelancer guru out of the US. I've met him a couple of times now, actually. He says 50% of your time should be spent on new business and 50% of your time should be driving is current client work. And I see that new business side of things as my social media. So it is something like half my time is now devoted to creating content for places like Instagram and TikTok. But you wouldn't believe how much that has diversified my income off of client work. Actually building a following on social media, building a community allows me to do things like eventually sell courses, digital products, and then, paid advertising on my site. And then other things like public speaking and sort of live streaming with people like Adobe. It's just opened up all these doors for me to the point where logo design is now actually not my main source of income anymore. It's the other side of things, the social side. So it's somewhere. Mid last year, I think it was, the scales tipped in terms of me being a kind of content creator, which is kind of scary, but quite exciting at the same time.
But it's content creation based in doing what you love, which is what made you go freelance in the first place.
That's right. And as a freelancer, I could never do this as a full-time employee. It dedicates so much of my time. I need to be able to split my day and manage my time how I need to in order to get this done. So it is literally like I'll start the first half of the day working with on my client work and looking at my leads and sort of speaking to clients in that respect. So the morning will be, getting on calls with people. In the afternoon, it'll be busting out a video or coming up with something, some kind of idea to do, the next piece of content from. So, if I was working in a job, like a full-time role, I would have to do all of that in the evenings and on the weekends. And there's no way I'd be able to, get that kind of a following. So
if you're getting, you post a video and then 70 people are getting in touch, presumably in DMs to say, I'd like a logo. What do you do at that point? Are you just pointing them towards that form on your website or?
Kind of. Yeah, so you'd be surprised, actually. Not a lot of the leads come via DMs. I force them through to my website, especially on places like TikTok, because it's harder for people to get in touch with you via messaging, or at least it used to be. They would have to go to your website to check you out and then get in touch. And then if anybody messages me on Instagram, I have like a text replacement thing. I just press I in my iPhone now, and it replaces it with a piece of text saying, sorry, I don't deal with leads on Instagram DMs. If you want to get in touch, email me here and we'll take the conversation there. Just allows me to track that conversation a bit easier because it'll get lost in Instagram DMs. So I immediately move them off the platform and capture that email and then, you know, get in contact with them that way.
Brilliant. In that case, on your form, is it saying, how did you hear about me? Because you're obviously able to...
It is. Exactly right. So yeah, that's the second question. How did you hear about me? Is it through SEO? Is it through Instagram? Is it through TikTok? And now I have a CRM that kind of pins that lead to a dedicated place. So I can always keep an eye on my analytics and see where all these leads are coming from. And if anything starts to dip or anything starts to, you know, grow, I can put more resources into that. But yeah, it's like just looking at the stats, it's so easy for me to select. It's something like 85% of leads is through the social side of things. So it's just a complete no-brainer to be dedicating my time.
Brilliant. Is that a like an automated CRM type process? What's the CRM?
Yeah, so I work with a company called Bloom, and they have a portal that basically is just a from the call to action on my website goes through to a landing page with a really, it's like a job form thing, basically. Just like a really, really simple questionnaire. But you can do all sorts with that. I can book projects and do invoicing and contracts through that system as well. Also have like a lovely little project workflow, so I can see which projects are coming up. I've got it all scheduled out. It's really handy. Like, I don't need an assistant to help me with that kind of stuff. So it's brilliant. And I can also send emails from it as well. So ideally, when a lead comes through, it's basically just me pressing a button, assigning that client to a specific tag and then sending them an email directly from the system. And it's honestly, it's turned my life around, because it used to be I would spend an hour and a half in the morning responding to emails from all the leads that would come through. Now it takes me 10 minutes. I'm like click, 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 and they're all done, ready for me to start my day.
Amazing. You said you don't need an assistant to help you do that. So do you have anybody helping you at all?
I do now. Yeah, this is one of the biggest challenges I faced as a freelancer, was relinquishing a bit of control and hiring an assistant to help me do the things that just weren't a great use of my time. And I did a podcast last year with a guy called Josh Hall, who is like a web designer pro and runs courses on people on how to, you know, start their own web design businesses. And he actually did a one-on-one with me and sort of guided me through the process of hiring my first assistant. Had me break down what are the pros and cons about my daily life. What do I like doing and what do I don't like doing? And how can I offset the things that I don't like to somebody else? And it took a while. I put the call out for an assistant at some point last year. I think it was last year. And now a lovely lady called Beatrice, who lives in Germany, helps me out with my client presentations, my logo exports, building brand guideline documents for clients, all the kind of stuff that I can do, but it's not necessarily the most creative part of the job. She totally helps me out with all of that. And even now, she's starting to come on board more with the actual concepting of around logos. And now before I start on a job, she does a little bit of research for me. She helps me out with a few concept ideas. She takes on some of the client brief questionnaires and answers and does her own thing for a little bit. And then I'll take that on and kind of pick up from where she started and finish the job. So it's been absolutely amazing.
You know, it's not somebody who deals with your calendar or sorts out the emails because, hey, you've ticked that one off in 10 minutes. It's actually the client work side of it, the actual design bit of it.
It's the time-consuming side of things, yeah. It's like exporting logos and doing brand guidelines documents can be so time-sucking. It's ridiculous. But it's so important, and every client needs to have one. And making that beautiful presentation is half of the job, with sort of selling in a new logo design idea. But it takes ages. It takes, you know, just a lot of grunt work with pulling up Photoshop mockups. And I write all the copy for the presentations. I'd like to control that, and it's my tone of voice, so you are working with me. But when it comes to like exporting something like a business card markup, I don't need to do that. I can have somebody help me with that. And that's what Beatrice does for me, and she's fantastic. She's been really, really helpful. But now she's starting to, like, now that we've had that relationship and she's done all of this kind of legwork with me, she's coming on board more for the sort of more creative side of things now, which is really exciting. So it could hopefully free up my time even more, to the point where she might eventually take on the job, the jobs completely, and maybe I'll bring on somebody else to help out her with her grant design work. And now we've started an agency, which is quite exciting. The problem is at the minute is I'm too much of a control freak. I just absolutely have to control that process. And I'm part of the reason that I think people are coming to me is because they want to work directly with me. And as a freelancer, I think that's kind of important. Otherwise, you're kind of working with an agency. So there's you know, ums and ahs with that with me. I'm not quite sure where I'm going to go. I'm at a bit of an inflection point right now. But I still enjoy the client work. And one of the great things about me still doing client work is it keeps me on the ground and it keeps me fresh with the software, which allows me then to teach it better to others and make courses about, you know, what's coming out and the new features and releases of products like Adobe Illustrator. I'm right on the front line. I'm doing it with you. So, you know, I'm not losing my edge.
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons, I think, for me to kind of stay in the game.
I was going to ask, actually, about this, the sort of content that you're creating and putting out there. Is it all aimed at other designers? And yet bringing you logo work because people are just going, flipping heck, he's good. Is that the...
Yeah. So the way I treat it is I have like the four pillars of content. I'm not even sure I can remember these now. Yeah, like software tips and tricks, freelancer advice, case studies, and there's one more. I always forget it. It's like the principles of design. So, or you know, it's basically how to be a better designer and how to be a better freelancer. And what happens is my following has grown because of that value that I've kind of given back. But clients are looking at this or seeing it on their feed, or anyone kind of interested in design, or maybe even someone that's just like searched on social for like logo designer, I'll come up because of that. And that's, you know, search on socials should not be overlooked in terms of SEO. If you do good captions, you'll come up in those searches for things like logo design when people are looking for it. And all of a sudden, who's this guy who's got like 500,000 followers and can design logos? Like, you know, and then that's why people are starting to get in touch more. Also kind of means that I can charge a little bit more as well, because, you know, I've got to a point where I'm working with bigger clients because of the success on social media. I've set the tone a little bit with my content, and there's going to be really no surprises now when someone gets in touch that it is going to cost a certain amount. So it totally helps. But yeah, I do, all the content is for designers. It's so great because it just serves both audiences. Graphic designers get something out of it. It makes me feel great because I feel like I'm teaching and imparting knowledge onto the next generation of designers and building a community at the same time. It's honestly a complete no-brainer.
When was the first course, or perhaps maybe not a course, but when was the first time that you created something that you could sell to help the audience that you'd created?
So initially, when I had a bit of success on TikTok, I was getting questions on, you know, interviews and things like that. Like, how have you done this? How have you built this following? So I made a short course about how to win more design clients with TikTok. And I did a little public speaking thing for a design summit a few years back. That was my first kind of taster into, like, I'd made this piece of content for this public speaking gig. I cut it into chunks and sold it as a course. Didn't do very well because I didn't market it very well. I didn't know how to sell it. I hadn't really built an audience and had no emails. Didn't have an email list to sell to. A year or two later, I tried it again with my latest course, which was Turbocharge Your Logo Designs, like how to go faster in Adobe Illustrator. And I partnered up with Skillshare on this one because at that point I had a bit of a following and they contacted me, and it's been amazing. It's a totally different experience. Like, people like the fact that I can kind of explain, design principles and explain design software really succinctly. So I've had so much experience trying to get all this content down into under a minute for something like a TikTok or an Instagram Reels. It now means I kind of really cut the bullshit when, you know, my courses aren't like wiffly waffly. They're really truncated and to the point. So when someone comes to my course and it's like an hour and 15 minutes, it's hard for me because I'm trying to get more money for the course, but they look at the length of the content and go, that's not very much. And then someone does the course and they're like, I just got more out of that than I probably would have done, you know, had I watched a 6 hour long video. There's so much in there. So the reviews on like places like Skillshare have been so good, and the feedback has been really glowing. You know, they have this little slider on Skillshare that says, does this course meet your expectations or exceed them? And like 75% of the reviews are like, exceeded my expectations, because there's just so much that I can say so quickly that it's just because of the nature of my content has just been so succinct. I can really just get the point across now.
Yeah, it's cool, isn't it? But actually, that limitation, that restriction of a 60-second video makes you focus.
So I script everything. Like I find it really hard to talk on camera, or at least I used to. I script everything when I do my social media. So I write it all out in notes. I record to the camera, say a line, read the next line, record, and then cut all those clips together. So it takes 4 minutes into, you know, under a minute. And also it's meant that I'm better on camera, and I'm better at sort of, now I'm better at articulating with clients. It makes me a better salesperson. I'm totally getting practice by making this content that I'm actually able to talk to clients with more conviction and more gusto. And it's absolutely fantastic. It just serves so many, it has so many benefits. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. You said that, you know, you didn't really have an email when you put out that first course, email list, that is. What did you do to try and build that? Because you've got that social following, but what about people that you can just reach out to?
That's still a work in process for me, if I'm honest. Bringing my audience off the platform and trying to take more ownership of them. Because let's say Instagram closed down tomorrow, I would lose 500,000 people and have no way to get them back. So I've been slowly trying to build my email list by offering out freebies here and there, you know, like sections from my course, downloads, that kind of thing, trying to build that up. And also, that's another part of the business I've actually hired some help with. I hired a copywriter to help me do my newsletters, because I was really struggling to get those out every week. A lovely lady here in Australia called Anna is now helping me with my content for my newsletters, which is such a weight off my shoulders. I always find that a real burden, having to put those together. And now she's totally taken that on board, which is amazing. So yeah, it's about kind of providing more value there. I've got a landing page for my newsletter now. So it's actually like a dedicated thing. I'm trying to actually build it. It's not huge. It's like 5,000 subscribers. Compared to socials, that's nothing. But actually, in terms of like when you want to sell to somebody or plug a digital course, that's pretty powerful. So yeah, still building that.
Getting a copywriter on board is quite cool. When you said you found it a burden, and yet you are obviously good with words, you like writing the copy in your brand guidelines and things. So was it more like the time?
That's it. And this has been one of the hardest parts, is that I do think I'm, it's one of my strong suits, as I've always written very well. I'm quite articulate when it comes to like creating articles and blog posts, and it's something that I've always done. And it helps with the script writing as well. It allows me to get my point across quicker, because I'm actually half decent at writing. So when my new assistant Anna sends me copy over, it's been quite a steep learning curve in terms of my kind of tone of voice. And I think she struggled with my direction, because I wasn't really giving her any. Just, you know, she would write a newsletter for me, and I would say, I don't really say words like that. That's kind of not how I speak. I like to write very colloquially. I like to write how I talk. So she's had to really learn quickly. But she's done a great job. And now it's getting to the point where I'll give her some topics to do for a newsletter and some topic ideas, and she'll structure that content out for me, and I'll just tweak a few things and we'll get it out there. It could be getting to the point as well that she might start writing articles for me and helping me with that to put a bit more content on my site in terms of like the actual articles. But yeah, it's only been something like 8 weeks, I think it's been. So it's very fresh.
There's obviously been this diversification in what you're putting out there and your income streams and things. Have we touched upon all of them?
All of the income streams, obviously client work, a little bit from public speaking, not too much, but you know, I do whenever there's something like an online summit and or something like Adobe Max, when I went to LA last year to speak there, that is just something like 10% of the business now, which is great. And I love that. And I really want to get more into the kind of public speaking space. Affiliate deals and brand partnerships is a big one. And then, yeah, the other one was digital products, the courses, which I'm just dipping my toe into right now, but we'll get there. Hopefully we'll expand that as the years go by.
I'm just going to double check. Did I dream this up once upon a time? Did you create like brands in order to sell a brand?
Yeah, a long time ago. I tried that out. So what happened was, so I've always had a line in my terms of service that says any unused artwork that I create as part of your logo design process belongs to me. So what happens is often you'll pitch a design idea to a client and they don't like it. In my mind, that's still a great design that might be applicable for another client. So I'll just put that on the shelf and maybe I'll pick that up later on. And that happened with a job a few years back where the client didn't like the logo. And I was like, oh, that's a real shame. That's a nice design. What I did was I made a fully fledged brand for something like a startup to just pick up off the shelf and run with. And it was called Karma, K-A-R-M-R. And it had this lovely sort of endless knot logo with organic growth coming out the top of it. Somebody ended up buying it. And I had a website to go with it. And the only issue with that is it's quite an investment of time to create a fully fledged brand, like a full brand guidelines document, the logo files, the marketing assets, the website, the presentation decks. It's a lot of work to put in for no return, which is the only reason I kind of didn't carry on doing that. So I tried it once more with a company with a logo called SunoWave. Not as good, and it just didn't sell. And to be honest, I haven't really pushed it. I haven't really put it out there in terms of like marketing it at all. I imagine if I did it now on my channels, I'm sure someone would buy it. But it's kind of just sat there at the moment, and it's on my shop. So it was like a little secondary income. But the model just didn't really work for me because there was too much time I needed to put into it with no guaranteed return. Whereas like putting that same amount of time into something like a course, where it's much easier to sell that as in terms of value, rather than creating a brand for a company that doesn't exist yet so that they can crowbar their company into that slot, it's a bit harder. It rubbed a few people up the wrong way when I started posting about that, because obviously people were like, well, a brand should be tailor-made for your business. Why would anybody do that? But then there's other people who are like, that's a great idea. You could totally create a startup and then with about 10 to 20 hours design time, fill in the blanks and write the copy and change some of the design to fit what you need it to. So it was an interesting model, but just for me, it just didn't work out.
It's when I saw it, it did make me think, huh, he's someone who looks like he's enjoying playing around with, I guess, like the entrepreneurial businessy side of. You might not have known what the hell you were doing when you started, James, but that you embrace it. That's what I saw when I saw that.
Yeah, it's just trying to make more money, isn't it? I've tried it all, honestly. Like selling merch, you know, I've got a shop on my website that sells t-shirts. Nobody buys those. It was just how to make more cash, to be honest.
Just wanted to take a quick break to remind you that there is actually a course that I created for new freelancers. So if that's you, check it out. But if it's not you, but you know somebody who's either about to get started being freelance or perhaps is in their first year, this can really help them out. I break down everything from business mindset, finding clients, attracting them, dealing with them, you know, like project management, invoicing contracts, pricing. What else do we cover? Not burning out. Frankly, I think that's an important thing to look at as well. Sure, there's no one way of being freelance, as I've well learned from speaking to over 300 guests for the podcast. But it's not just my experience. It's those who I have spoken to over the past 9 years plus. And they can be helping you too. Go to beingfreelance.com, click on course, and the course also comes with 6 months free membership of the Being Freelance community. So not just are you learning how to get started, but you're doing it surrounded by people who are already doing it. So you've got this support network and friends to be made to. beingfreelance.com has all the details. Right now, let's get back to James's story. I introduce you as being in Australia. You're not from Australia. So when did you head out there?
So we came here 3 years ago, right in the middle of the pandemic. So I had to do 2 weeks of quarantine in a hotel room with my daughter, who was 2 at the time, which was not fun. But yeah, my wife's Australian. We met in the UK at one of my publishing role jobs, and we've been together. We've been married since 2016 now. So, she's Australian. We moved out here just because she had a bit of the call of home and she wanted to be back closer to her family and give, you know, the other grandparents a bit of time with the kids. And we love it here now. It's fantastic. My daughter's just started school, so I'm firmly entrenched in the Australian way of life. And obviously being a freelancer, I can work from anywhere. The only issue is here is the time difference. It's a real pain with working with places like the UK and parts of the States. Like I think the East Coast America is the most difficult because there's not one single hour in the day that crosses over in business hours. One of us has to take a call in the evening or early morning, something like 5 in the morning or 10 at night. So it can be a huge pain there. But you know, largely, if you can get around that, it's fantastic. You know, the lifestyle's immense. I have a a spare room in my house, which is my office, a dedicated office. I'm very lucky. And I do have two young children who I love spending time with. And the freelance lifestyle means that I'm home for every dinner. I get to put them down every night for bed and spend as much time with them as I possibly can in these, the fun years when they're, you know, bouncing around and causing trouble, being very cute. But yeah, it's, I wouldn't have it any other way now. I don't think I could ever go back to a full-time role. I'm too far gone now. I'm a freelancer for life.
So work-life balance-wise, it's going all right.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good. Like I've always kind of burnt the candle in terms of like working evenings. I rarely do weekends now. I definitely work evenings here though, because of the time difference, it's easier to get on the phone with people. And to be honest, the kids go down at 7. So I've got a few hours at the end of the day with a little bit of peace and quiet that I can actually get some work done. And I start my day just a little bit later. Each day I'll do a gym class in the morning and I'll probably pick up, you know, turn my computer on about 11 a.m. Most days, I have one day a week where I kind of do the normal 9 to 5 when my daughter's in school and my son, who's 2, he goes to daycare. But yeah, it, like I say, it's fantastic in terms of like being home for dinners and getting there for the bedtimes. There's no commutes. I just open the door and I'm there. So yeah, I wouldn't have that any other way now.
You say there's no commute, right? But do you have a process of like switching off between that workspace and the home space?
Yeah, it's tough. I think that that's one of the biggest issues with dealing with being a freelancer, isn't it? Like that separation. Just as a business owner as well, trying to do something that doesn't occupy your mind makes you feel so guilty. It's like you should be putting all this time into your business. Like over the Christmas break, I had to do things like jigsaws just so that my mind was occupied, so that I wouldn't feel guilty about not working on my business and turning the computer on and doing something there. It's strange, isn't it? When you are your sole provider and you're the only person bringing in money, you feel like all your spare time should be, you know, invested in doing that. So it is really hard to kind of switch off from the work, and especially because of the social media with me as well. Now I have to really put my phone to the side, especially at dinner time. I still struggle to do, you know, to put it over in the corner. One of my friends has a great piece of advice he gave me, which I totally need to implement. I haven't done it yet, is when he walks in the door, he puts his phone on the counter by the door and leaves it there. He's allowed to use his phone as much as he wants, but he has to go to the counter to use it. So it's a physical thing. He has to move to actually, you know, pick the phone up and actually get to it. And it's meant that he's totally separated his phone and social life. So I need to, you know, start putting those barriers in place. But it is really hard. It is really hard, especially as a freelancer, because you feel like you need to be on all the time. You feel like you need to be answering emails from clients and being timely with your responses. And that's tough. So yeah, it's always a struggle.
Do you also find that, especially at this point you're in now, James, where you've got successful client work, you build up this following, so there's all these opportunities that must be coming your way, and so many things where you go, oh, I could do this, I could do that. How do you choose what to actually focus on? Do you put things on a back burner, or like, what's that like in your head?
Yeah, it's usually the ones that could be done the fastest. Like I really want to do, like, write a book, for instance. It's one of my you know, goals in life, is to write a book around the logo design. And I was actually approached a year or two ago to write a book by a publisher, and got to the point where we couldn't really find the promise of the book, like what the book would do for people. But at the same time, that project is so long. That's like months and months and months of work, which I would have to chip at over the course of a year. Whereas something like making a video for social media, I can do in a few hours and it's done. So it's always been about, like, you know, finding the projects that I think can be done in the timeliest fashion, which will keep me interested in the project, first of all, because I always struggle with that, like losing interest in something as time goes on, especially with logo design, because, you know, sometimes those projects can drag. So yeah, keeping that momentum has been kind of hard. So something like a digital course, like a longer course about the full process of logo design, is something I've always wanted to do. But that, I know from experience now, that that's like a 3-month to 4-month project that I would have to put client work off for to get done, because I just would not be able to dip in and out of it. It's too distracting to switch in and out of some of a project like that. My last course I did in the space of 6 weeks, and it was so intense. I dropped all my client work, really put the back burner on the socials just to get through it, filmed it and edited it all myself, scripted it, screen recorded everything, made the website, did absolutely everything. I was so burnt out by the end of the process that I kind of needed to take a holiday from that. But yeah, I'll get back to that at some point. So yeah, I think it's just a case of me finding a project and being able to project manage it so that I can dip in and out of it over the course of a few months is one of the reasons, one of the sort of ways that I'll make a decision on what to do next.
Yeah. Man, that passive income is so easy, right?
Yeah. It's insane.
Now, James, I always do this thing where I ask for three facts about yourself to make two true, one a lie, and let me figure out the lie. What do you have for me?
All right. I thought I would stay in the theme of, you know, going viral. Okay. So I've gone viral a lot. Some of my videos have done very well. Before doing content with graphic design, I've actually been viral twice before. So I'm going to tell you three things that I've gone viral for, and you have to pick which one I didn't go viral
for. Okay, cool.
All right. I was once featured in almost every national newspaper in the UK, all because Nestle forgot to pay me a competition prize. Number two. I was once featured in almost every publication in Ireland because I look a little bit like one of their politicians. Number three. I was once on the front page of Reddit and then all of the video socials like Lad Bible and Facebook at the time after a video of me kicking a snowman went viral.
Oh, I hope that's true. Okay. What was the competition for you won with Nestle?
Okay. When I was a kid, I found a green polo in my packet of polos and I won £10. And I sent it off to Nestle. And didn't hear anything back for something like 17 years until I was walking to work one day, saw a kid eating a green sweet. I went, hang on, hey, I never got my 10. And I remembered. So I wrote a letter to Nestle. The letter went viral. And then they responded with a check for £10 and a packet of polos saying, sorry. And the headline in the newspaper was, Nestle issues an apology.
Oh, okay. Surely this is true. Either that or you have done wonders with your backstory because that's brilliant.
These all have huge backstories. So, yeah. Which one's right?
That does sound like the sort of promotion that they would do. I can't see Netflix making the same documentary that they did about the kid who won a jet plane from Pepsi all those years ago. Okay, you look like an Irish politician, but yes. How did they pick that up? How did you end up in all the newspapers?
The politician was, they were campaigning at the time, so they were on the TV, and I saw them on the TV, and I was like, it looks quite a lot like me, and one of my friends sent me a picture of them saying, what? Like, you look just like this bloke. So I tweeted him with the picture saying, I'll be your stunt double if you want. And he retweeted it and all of the publications picked it up. And I was on the homepage of the BBC News Ireland. And I then went to the Houses of Parliament and met him.
You did not. Hang on. Which Houses of Parliament?
The big ones. The ones in London.
The ones in London. So this is a Northern Ireland politician.
Yes.
Is that true? And I hope you take this as a compliment because you're a good looking chap, James. So now I'm thinking, more like Hugh Jackman. Could I imagine...
Politician that looks like Hugh Jackman. Politician. Not like Hugh Jackman. I've never heard that before. Thanks, man. You made my day.
Okay, number three. So you end up kicking a snowman. Why did you kick the snowman? I don't want us to turn into therapy, but...
Okay, this was in 2014. In a park in London. I was with my wife and we made this snowman. She's from Australia, so she's never seen the snow before. So snowman was a big deal. We made this huge snowman with an enormous ball for the base. And then it was like getting a bit cold. We're going to go home. But there were some kids like eyeing up our snowman nearby and they were totally going to like kick it down. So I thought, sod that. Like I get that privilege as the person who made the snowman. I'm kicking this snowman down. So I take a running leap at the snowman, kick it. My foot slips over the top of the snowman and hit myself in the balls. My wife filmed this, by the way. I posted it to Reddit and it hit millions of views, and then it went on places like Lad Bible and Facebook, and with the title Snowballs.
Oh my god, these are amazing lies. Right, the snowman story sounds like it could totally be true. We don't often get snow in the UK that is that good, so you would have been excited. You would have gone out, especially with an mm-hmm. Australian wife or girlfriend yeah. at the time. Newspaper. Would Nestle, do Nestle even make polos? The Northern Irish politician is a really odd one to come up with. And especially the idea of then going and meeting him at the Houses of Parliament. Yeah, I don't know. I reckon it's the Northern Irish politician. That's the lie.
Do you have your web browser up in front of you?
Go on, what's his name?
Google Colm Eastwood doppelganger. Colm, C-O-L-U-M. He's from Northern Ireland. He is the leader of the SDLP. And he looks exactly like me. And he should be. There should be a video there of me meeting him at the Houses of Parliament.
Oh my god! It really is. If you type that into Google yeah. and go to images, you see the two of them standing next to each other.
From certain angles, he looks exactly like me. It's ridiculous. We stayed in touch ever since that. He retweeted that. It got picked up by. You wouldn't believe the day I had. It was insane that it got picked up by every national. Publication in Ireland, pretty much, Northern Ireland. It was on the homepage of the BBC News Irish website. I was asked to go on the radio, but I turned it down because I was so worried about saying the wrong thing or getting into trouble. It was absolutely crazy. So, yeah, that's absolutely true.
That is brilliant.
Do you want to have a guess at which one is the lie still? Or
do you know? I will. Nestle never coughed up £10. Apology is a brilliant headline. Maybe you've even seen it somewhere. But that didn't happen.
I'm afraid it did.
Oh my god! I've never been so bad at this game.
I win. Look behind me. This is the check they sent me. I covered these up with Post-it notes. if you're watching online, I have it framed on my wall, the letter I wrote to Nestle. They did. They responded 17 years later with a box of polos and an apology. I was in every single national newspaper as a small little headline. It was on like the Huffington Post. It was ridiculous. The fake one is the snowman. I made that up.
I'm so yeah. It was just so
absolute bullshitter.
Cross myself. Well I done. They were brilliant.
Thank you.
Well played. all right, James. If you could tell your younger self one thing about being freelance, what would that be?
Don't be afraid to relinquish control. More control. Basically, hire an assistant. Get there faster and get on camera. Get on camera as fast as you possibly can. I can't tell you how much my life has changed by imparting the knowledge and passing it all on to the next generation of graphic designers. I had the idea for it years ago, honestly. I saw some videos by a company called InVision about making like design snacks, and I had the idea to do it. I just didn't have the conviction to kind of put it forward. But it just took one video going viral to give me the motivation I needed and the leads that I needed to keep that kind of content coming. So yeah, get on camera and relinquish some control.
And I love the fact that you said that getting on camera also made you better dealing with clients, the confidence that you got from it as well earlier on.
It's so handy. So it's a handy skill to have, definitely.
But when people talk about putting across their life, you know, like showing, you show behind the scenes of your work, but do you keep that side of everything private? I don't see you on the beaches in Australia.
Nah, I don't really share that kind of stuff. I have a personal social account, and I keep all of my kids to that. So only, you know, that's private. That part of my life isn't for public consumption. Yeah, I'm not posting holiday snaps unless I go somewhere to do a public speaking gig, and that totally is a trip for me, and I'll post about that. So I did lots of pictures of LA when I was there. But yeah, I do keep them separate. One's for my family and friends, and one's for the rest of the world.
Nice. Go to beingfreelance.com. There'll be links through so you can find everything that James is up to. It's well worth delving into everything that he's doing. As I always say, it doesn't matter about what people do for a living. It's about the being freelance. And you might sit there thinking, oh, well, James is talking about design and I'm not a designer. Doesn't matter. Go follow what he's doing, and I think you'll really enjoy it and be intrigued by what he's doing.
Thank you.
But for now, James, thank you, and all the best being freelance.
Thanks a lot, mate. Take care.
If you want to join us in the community, just go to beingfreelance.com and click the button. Come find us. We've got our new book club coming up. We're going to be reading Do Penguins Eat Peaches, which is an excellent title. Whether it's a good book or not, I don't know, but I was sucked in by the title, I must admit. It's all about market research using big company market research ideas for our small businesses. Should be good. I don't know why I'm holding it up. You can't see it through the microphone, but still. Anyway, I'll see you for a new episode of this very soon indeed. If not, in the community sooner, because I'm always hanging out in there. And you have a great week. Being freelance.